Now, here's Jack Patty.
Good morning. Welcome. It is the first American DA Live episode of the new year. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, he is in the studio with us this morning. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
And producer Chase Barnett. Good morning, Chase.
Good morning, Jack.
Glad to have you with us. And an interesting, very high-profile case we're going to talk about this morning. Ray, bring us up to speed, sir.
Well, Jennifer Hudson is, you know, when a celebrity is involved in a case, whether it's peripherally or otherwise, then that case picks up a lot of notoriety. And in this case, Jennifer Hudson's mother, brother, and nephew were murdered in 2008. And the lead prosecutor in the case is Jim McKay, and Jim is in Chicago, at the state's attorney's office. That's what they call the prosecutor in Illinois, a state's attorney. We call them Commonwealth attorneys. Of course, I've been called a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And with him is the person that sat in the second chair, and that's Jennifer Bagby. So, Jim, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Jim and Jennifer.
How you doing?
Well, thanks.
Can Jennifer hear us?
Yes, she can. If she has any questions, I'll just hand the handset over to her.
Great.
Okay, that's good. Jennifer, you probably run the show anyway.
Good morning.
So, Jim, tell us a little bit about the Cook County State's Attorney's Office and the jurisdiction that you all represent. Tell us the population of your jurisdiction.
Sure. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office is the local prosecutors for Cook County, which encompasses all of the city of Chicago and the outlying suburbs. The total population of Cook County is somewhere around 8-9 million people. About 3 million of that would be the population of the city of Chicago. And we're responsible for prosecuting all of the state crimes committed in Cook County, anywhere from murder all the way down to any misdemeanors, including DUIs and serious traffic offenses.
And the Cook County State's Attorney is Anita Alvarez, and has been a friend of mine for a long time. So let's talk a little bit about the office there, the Cook County State's Attorney's office. It's one of the larger offices in the entire country.
Yes, it is. In fact, I believe it's the second largest, second only to Los Angeles. We have around 800 assistant state's attorneys here in Cook County, and we do everything from trials all the way to appeals. Obviously, our Criminal Prosecutions Bureau is the largest bureau in the office. We have about 400 or 500 assistants in that bureau, and the assistants there handle all of the crimes in Cook County. But in addition to that, we have a Special Prosecutions Bureau that handles special types of cases such as gang crimes or arson or financial crimes. We have our own civil division that represents the county in civil matters, whether it's a county tax issue or some of the ASAs in the Civil Bureau are representing doctors in our county hospital on medical malpractice cases. We have our own appeals division. We handle our own appeals after we successfully prosecute them at the trial level. And they're spread out all over Cook County. We have, I believe, around 52 felony trial courtrooms throughout Cook County, most of them at the criminal courthouse at 26th and California. But in addition to that, we have misdemeanor branch courts throughout the city. We have 5 suburban courthouses that handle the traffic, misdemeanor, and felony cases out in the suburbs near those 5 courthouses.
So, well, all I can tell you is that it's good to live in a little simpler situation like we have here in Lexington. Okay, so you've been a prosecutor for, I think you told me, 27 years. And that means that you probably are one of the experienced prosecutors in that office. What is your assignment?
My current title is Chief of the Complex Prosecutions Unit. The name was changed a couple of years ago when the state of Illinois abolished the death penalty. Before that, I was a chief of the Capital Litigation Unit, which handled all of the death penalty cases.
Right. Well, tell us about this case involving what the guy's name is Balfour.
William Balfour was
right. How did you become aware of this homicide and this defendant, and what was your role? And tell us about the investigation of this case.
Well, I became aware of the case, as did most of the city and probably most of the nation because of all the media exposure. But on October 24, 2008, Jennifer Hudson's mother and brother were shot and killed in their home on the south side of Chicago. And then Jennifer's nephew, 7-year-old Julian King, had been kidnapped and was missing for a total of 3 days before his body was found shot to death in a vehicle on the west side, about maybe 3 or 4 miles away from the Hudson family house on the south side. It was all over the news, obviously. The defendant was Julia Hudson's estranged husband.
And that was her, that's her sister?
Julia Hudson is Jennifer Hudson's sister.
And is this 7-year-old Julian King, her Jennifer Hudson's sister's son?
Yes.
Okay.
Not the defendant's biological son, mm-hmm. but Julia's only child, actually.
Okay, so at what point did you realize that this case is going to get a little attention because of the notoriety of this Jennifer Hudson?
From the moment it happened, the media was covering it not long after Julia Hudson returned home from work and discovered her mother dead, her brother dead in the house, and her child missing. The media was all over the house that afternoon and throughout the weekend, and there was a citywide search for young Julian until his body was discovered 3 days later. It was a media event on all levels, and about a little over a month later, when William Balfour was actually charged, it became a media event then here at the courthouse because of the attention it was given. The media was here almost every court date, even on status dates throughout the discovery process.
So what kind of a problem does that create for this celebrity involvement? What kind of problems does that create for the prosecutor and obviously the police investigators?
It creates a problem on a number of levels, not the least of which is while the media has a right to get information and disseminate that to their listeners or viewers or readers, the defendant has a right to a fair trial. So the prosecutor's caught in the middle between those two interests and must balance it. And there's ethical rules that come into play as to what we as prosecutors can say to the media before the trial and conviction is obtained. So we're constantly fielding questions from the media, whether it's out in the hallway after a court date or, a telephone call in the office. And many times we cannot comment while the case is pending. In addition to that, when the case is being investigated and up until the time of charging, the police are fielding several questions from the media. And many times they're limited as to what they can say. And as prosecutors, we're somewhat responsible for what the police are saying before charging. So that's one of the issues a prosecutor has to deal with.
We're not somewhat responsible. We're responsible for if they come out and start mouthing about the facts of a case and the credibility of witnesses, the judges aren't going to look at the police. They're going to look at the prosecutor and say, what's going on here, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons that we don't we try, at least in Lexington, we try not to talk about a case that's pending. And
at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, nothing good happens when you talk about that.
And conversely, you'll see defense lawyers holding press conferences, you know, while the case is pending. And they owe a duty to their client and no one else, which is quite different than what a prosecutor's duties are in our criminal justice system. So many times the defense lawyer is saying a lot of things, and the prosecutor is limited to what he or she can say. And many times actually has no comment.
One of the things that, Jack, when we were trying the Shane Ragland case here, that's a, excuse me a minute, Jim, but when we were trying that case, one of the defense attorneys started demeaning the credibility of one of the witnesses. Well, that's a violation of the ethical rules. And so we made a motion basically to hold the guy in contempt for violating the ethical rules. Well, the judge didn't hold him in contempt, but stopped the conversation.
No.
Because he's not supposed to talk about the credibility of witnesses or anything else. But at any rate, okay, so all of a sudden this case is, how did they end up finding this William Balfour and connecting all of these cases to him, Jim?
Later on the day of the murders, early that evening, he was tracked down to a apartment on the west side of Chicago, which he shared with one of his girlfriends. Cell tower technology was employed by the police with the assistance of the FBI in tracking the defendant down. He was arrested in that apartment that night. Found on his person were some keys, one of which fit the door and the ignition to Jason Hudson's SUV, which had been stolen from the Hudson residence earlier that morning, and was the same vehicle in which Julian was found in 3 days later. So that was how he was arrested. He was arrested due in large part to Julia Hudson telling the police that afternoon she discovered the bodies about a conversation she had with her estranged husband that morning. He had been stalking her and showed up at her home while she was getting ready for work that morning, and they had a domestic argument, to say the least, regarding the status of their relationship.
So he was a suspect from the get-go then?
Yes.
Yeah. Taking a break, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll-free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, email jackpatty at wvlkam.com.
WVLK.
9:35, 25 minutes before 10, as Lexington's morning news continues. American DA Live, the first one of the new year. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson in the studio with us, and Chicago prosecutors Jim McKay and Jennifer Bagby on the phone. Ray?
Jim, so this guy was indicted, and he was, I guess, indicted for 3 counts of murder?
Yes.
And now, it comes time to try this case. How long did the trial last?
The trial lasted a total of 16 days. It took 2 days to pick the jury, 12 days to put all the witnesses on, and then the jury was out deliberating for 2 days. So
2 days?
Woo! 16.
Well, tell now, Chase has a question about the jury selection.
With the case receiving so much media attention, how did your office deal with the jury selection, and how did the defense deal with it as well?
Very good question. Actually, the judge had a lot to do with that. Because of the media attention, Judge Charles Burns decided that a jury questionnaire would be handed out to all the prospective jurors. They filled it out, and a lot of the questions in that questionnaire had to do with the media attention given to the case and whether or not that media attention would affect the jurors and would prevent them from being fair and impartial. So the Friday before, maybe 100 prospective jurors or so were given this questionnaire, filled it out. And then the following Monday, with these questionnaires filled out, both parties, along with the judge, began questioning these jurors one by one. And the judge made sure that none of the jurors who were finally selected were affected by all of the media attention that had been given this case for the three.
Now, when you say weren't affected, what does that mean?
Well, a juror has to declare under oath whether or not the media attention would affect their ability to be fair and impartial to both sides. So obviously, in a case like this, most of the jurors heard something about the case. Some of them candidly told the parties that they could not be fair. But that was relatively few. Most of the jurors told the court under oath that they could be fair and impartial despite the media attention that they had received in this particular case. They could set it aside and they can judge the case on the merits, on the facts presented in the courtroom, and follow the judge's instructions.
Is it easy?
And throughout the trial, the judge was constantly reminding the jury that the media attention would continue, but they were not in any way, shape, or form to watch television after court, read any of the newspapers, go online and read anything about the particular case. They were admonished this every day, every night, and the jurors followed the judge's court orders and ruled based on what the evidence was in this case.
And isn't it also so in these high-profile cases that involve celebrities, you got some people that want to serve on the jury and then write a book. Are they easy to spot?
Yeah, I suspect that they are in almost all of these cases. You can tell during the jury selection process that those types of jurors that want to be on the case and, you know, may have a different agenda than what the jurors are supposed to have, and that is to just listen to the evidence and decide the case on the evidence. You know, if you've been doing it as long as myself and Jennifer and our other partner, Viral Gambino, have been doing it, plus the defense, we're very experienced trial lawyers as well in this case. You can tell early on the type of juror who wants to get on a particular case. And when you have that type of juror, usually that juror is going to be excused because that juror can't follow the law.
What kind of jurors were the defense looking for?
Well, you'd have to ask them, Ray. But
I'm going to ask you.
Obviously, what they want jurors that are going to, lean towards the defense theory in this particular case. But frankly, because it is a procedure that, you know, both sides get an opportunity to ask the jurors questions and the judge is actively involved, you're able to dismiss those jurors that can't be fair to both sides, and you end up with a group of citizens that can listen to the evidence and decide the case on the evidence and follow the law. That's what you want. You want reasonable people, fair people that will follow the law. And I suspect most defense lawyers want that just as much as prosecutors.
Sure.
Everybody wants a fair trial. Nobody wants to try this case again.
Well, there were three of you prosecutors that were involved in this case, you, Jennifer Bagby, and Viral Gambino. So how did you divide up responsibility for parts of the trial?
Well, the three of us have been working on this case for, you know, the 3 years prior to the trial. Mm-hmm. And long before jury selection, we had decided who was going to handle which witnesses. You know, we called over 80 witnesses, so they were divided amongst the three of us. We had decided who was going to give the opening statement. In this case, it was Viral Gambino, who was going to give the opening argument, which Jennifer gave, and then who was going to do the rebuttal argument, which I gave. So that was decided long in advance. We also decided who was going to be cross-examining any defense witnesses, if the defendant was going to testify, who was going to cross-examine him. We worked together on the jury instructions in this case, and there were several instructions in this particular case. We were, throughout the discovery period, collecting all of the documents and police reports and lab reports and going out with our amazing investigators, talking to witnesses out on the streets, finding new witnesses that hadn't been discovered by the police earlier in the investigation, meeting with the people at the crime lab, meeting with people in the police departments, going out to the community and talking to neighbors and friends and
What was the defense for this Balfour guy?
The defense in this case was simply reasonable doubt. There was nothing more than that. No affirmative defense was alleged by the defense team. So they were just relying on the state's inability to prove their client guilty. But quite frankly, in my opinion, the evidence was overwhelming.
Was the defense team working for free?
Yes, they are assistant public defenders here in Cook County, and all of them are excellent lawyers and fine people.
I thought maybe these were high-profile guys that wanted the publicity.
You know, we certainly have seen that here in Illinois and some other high-profile cases.
Yeah.
But no, they were public defenders, and like many of the public defenders in Cook County, they do an excellent job and are not looking for publicity. Okay. They're just there to represent their clients to the fullest extent of the law.
And let me ask Jennifer a question.
Sure.
So, Jennifer, tell us what your role in this trial was.
Well, I was one of the assistants assigned to the courtroom where the case was pending, and so I was fortunate to be asked by Mr. McKay and Burl Gambino to try this case with them. So I took on the responsibility of most of the people from the crime lab. I am interested in the scientific aspect of being a prosecutor, so I focused on most of those witnesses, and then a number of civilian witnesses as well. And then I was fortunate enough to give the opening closing argument to
Now tell me how that works in Illinois, the opening closing argument.
Because in Illinois, because the state does have the burden of proof, we get to argue twice mm-hmm. at the end. So you give an opening close, which is more laying out the law for the jurors, going through the jury instructions, and writing how the facts and how our burden has been met through the facts of the case. And then the defense argues, and then following the defense argument, the state gets to then give a rebuttal argument addressing the issues brought up by the defense.
In our jurisdiction in Kentucky, that's just the defense makes a closing argument, and then it's followed by the prosecution making a closing argument. At any rate, that's interesting. Now, you say that the trial lasted 16 days.
16 days.
Uh-huh. Jim, what's, and the jury was out for 2 days?
Yeah. By the time the arguments were completed and the judge instructed the jury, it was in the middle of the afternoon on a Wednesday. The judge let them deliberate for a couple of hours more. By 8 o'clock that night, he stopped their deliberations and sequestered them, sent them to a hotel. So they only deliberated for a couple hours that first day. They returned the next day, Thursday, deliberated till maybe like 5 o'clock, from like 10 to 5. Hadn't reached a verdict yet, but then the next day, Friday, they had reached a verdict in the afternoon, and the defendant was convicted of all three murders and the kidnapping of Julian King.
All right, we're going to take a break and conclude. When we come back, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. WVLK, it's 11 minutes away from 10 o'clock. Our guests this morning, Chicago prosecutors Jim McKay and Jennifer Bagby. And Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson in the studio. Chase Barnett is with us as well. And we're talking about the case that involved the murder of Jennifer Hudson's family. You mentioned, Jim, that the jury was out for 2 days. During that 2 days, did they ask for any more information, any of the evidence to be represented to them?
Yes, which is common in many of the jury trials we do here in Cook County. Questions will be sent out to the judge from the jury asking for certain things or clarification of certain concepts or legal terms more often than not. And certainly was the case here. The judge is going to tell the jury that they received all the evidence and continue to deliberate. But there was a piece of evidence that for some reason did not go back to the jury room right after arguments, and that was the defendant's videotaped statement to the police upon his arrest. The day of the murders. He made a series of lies that we were able to show at trial were nothing but lies, and we showed that video statement to the jury during the trial, but for some reason the video disc was not sent back to the jury room for their deliberation, so they asked for that on that second day of jury deliberations, and then soon thereafter came back with their verdict.
Well, the so let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Hudson. Did she testified in the trial, didn't she?
Yes, she did, right.
And what was her what information was it that she was able to add to the case?
She added several things to the case. In most of the murder cases here, we call what we call life and death witnesses. And she was a life and death witness for the people of the state of Illinois in this case. She was the one that, in fact, she flew to Chicago once she heard of the horrific crimes. She identified all three bodies at the morgue. So she testified about that. She testified a little bit about the background regarding her family, her sister Julia, and the defendant, William Balfour, whom she knew as well, because early on in his life, he grew up in the same neighborhood that Jennifer did. In addition to those things, and probably more importantly, she was able to help set the time frame for the murders, because she and her mother had the habit of calling or texting each other every morning. And on the morning of this crime, Jennifer did not receive a text message from her mother. She thought that was unusual, and that coupled with the cell tower evidence that put the defendant in the neighborhood and ear witnesses, some young ladies that lived nearby that heard gunshots, we were able to show the jury that the murders happened between 9 and 10 a.m. on October 24th of 2008.
Well, we had the prosecutor of Michael Jackson on this show some years ago, and he made the comment that it never had occurred to him the impact of celebrity on a case. And he says, I think it would be very difficult to convict Michael Jackson of anything simply because he's such a celebrity. Same thing with Robert Blake, you know what I mean? Now, this case is not the same issue, but I'll guarantee you there was a lot of buzzing going around that courtroom when Jennifer Hudson made her appearance.
She clearly was somebody that the people in media wanted to see and hear testify. We called her for a reason that had nothing to do with the media attention.
Right.
She was able to testify about the entire family was against the marriage of William Balfour and Julia, when it happened. In fact, they learned about it after the fact. She also provided, like I said, the time frame for the murders to happen, which is critical in this particular case. But I suspect that when you have a high-profile case, and certainly when the defendant is a celebrity, in my opinion, the burden of proof goes up for the prosecutors because of that celebrity status of that particular defendant.
William, you mentioned, Jim, you mentioned that William received three life sentences. How long is that by Chicago standards?
Great question. In Illinois, natural life imprisonment means natural life. He is not eligible for parole. When this case was charged, Illinois had a death penalty. This was a death penalty case. But during the pendency of the case, the state abolished the death penalty. So the maximum sentence William Balfour could receive upon conviction would be natural life. It's also the minimum sentence because in Illinois, if you kill two or more victims, the minimum sentence is natural life. But at least at this point in our state, natural life means a natural life sentence, and he is never to get out of prison.
Now, that's interesting. You say at this point, because
God knows what our legislators are going to do years from now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have several murders in Cook County, and the more murderers who get convicted and the more who receive natural life sentences, I suspect 20, 30 years from now, the more crowded our prisons are going to be.
And who knows what the future holds in terms of the legislature?
Exactly.
We're out of time. Hey, Jim and Jennifer, thank you guys very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Very interesting. See you later, Jim.